Okay, it's 10 o'clock, so I'm sure people will come and go over the course of time, but I'll begin. And for anybody who doesn't know me, my name's Andrew Sims, and I am one of the coordinators of the Rapid Transition Alliance. We have convened this this webinar today. The Rapid Transition Alliance is, as the name suggests, an alliance of 50 plus organizations, which is international in nature. Its tagline is evidence-based hope in a warming world. And we do three things. One is gathering an evidence base of examples of rapid shifts towards sustainability, both historically and currently, and in many different geographies. And we have a website called rapidtransition.org where these stories of change and a mixture of resources and commentaries are collected. And the alliance itself is intended to kind of grow the conversation about the possibilities of rapid transition. And we also float particular sort of policy and advocacy ideas. And one of them, which has just gone live today, is about the idea for a fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty, for example. But today's webinar is very specific. It's been called to expand the conversation around, in the wake of the incredibly successful wave of declarations of climate emergencies, there is a kind of an awareness that the resources, the knowledge, the know-how of translating those declarations of climate emergency into practical local action plans is not there universally, that there is a gap. So that we wanted to begin to fill that gap with some contributions from people who've been very active in that space about trying to imagine what civic action plans to align with a 1.5 degree climate target might look like. Look at a few examples about what's happening internationally. Look at some of the advocacy going on to try and build the basis for action at the local level, and also to give a little bit of flavour of some of the practical things which are actually happening. This is because this is a webinar for. So all the normal simple protocol measures apply, which is to say that in order to channel questions, if you have a question, please post it in the chat line if things are occurring to you as people are speaking. It's the best way to keep track of them, and it's the most organized way in which we can make sure that everybody's points get heard. My colleague Peter Newell, who is online and my sort of co-organizer of the Rapid Transition Alliance, will be monitoring those and bringing those back in and putting them to the people presenting later. The running order is going to be, we're going to hear a little bit from my colleague Nikki Saunter, who works with the Alliance and is going to speak to some of the evidence base that we've been gathering. Then we're going to hear from the wonderful Paul Chatterton, who is both an activist and a theorist in this space and has looked at what the dynamics of a civic action plan to meet 1.5 will look like. Hopefully we will also be hearing from Katriona Curry, who has been leading the work at Friends of the Earth, working with their own network of local activists to put pressure on local authorities and work with local authorities to turn declarations into action. We have a short 3.5 minute film from Paul Allen, who leads the Zero Carbon Britain Initiative, where they are developing an innovations hub and a pack of support to be made available to local authorities wanting to make this transition. He's actually teaching on the Zero Carbon Britain course as we speak, which is why he can't be live with us, but we do have, like I say, a short film from him. And then we will go to Peter, who will coordinate some any I say questions, but if you have a contribution that you want to make that you can kind of share, that would be of great use too. Now, I think that my colleague Sophie, based at the at IDS down at Sussex University, is also recording this. One or two of the presenters may be switching screens to show you some slides. As ever, with the way that technology works on these things, we'll ride that as we go, and hopefully they'll be successful. If there are any glitches, bear with us and we'll work through them. And with that, the other simple protocol thing is, it's standard practice for this, is if you're not speaking, mute your microphone just to kind of keep background noise to a minimum. But I'm now going to hand over to my colleague Nikki Saunter, who's going to tell you a little bit about some of the practical work and what we're doing to try and gather stories of change and evidence-based hope in a warming world. And I suppose The only other final thing to say is that in terms of timing, it's peculiarly appropriate. We didn't actually deliberately design this to happen while the COP is going on in Madrid, nor on the day when it was announced that global emissions are still in aggregate rising when they need to be falling dramatically. So the importance of turning declarations of emergency into practical action at the local level could not be greater. I will now silence myself and hand over to Nikki. Nikki.
Thanks, Andrew. Hi, everyone. My name is Nikki Saunter, and I work as a writer and researcher for the Rapid Transition Alliance. So my job is basically to keep on top of ideas of things that are happening in the world, either at the macro level or micro level, and also to look historically at things that have happened in the past that have shown successfully how you can transition from high carbon to low carbon. And some of those ideas are you know, way back in the past, like dig for victory, use of land after the Second World War, and some of them are very, very recent. I thought it would be a good idea just to mention a few different case studies on the website. So hopefully most of you have had a look at the website already. There's a particular area called stories, and that's where the case studies are cited. So we think it is important to remember that they are stories, real shared stories, and we also encourage members to share their own stories. So second part of my role is to encourage people who are members of the Alliance, and also people like yourselves, who some of you may not be members of the Alliance already, to share interesting ideas and short stories that you think would make case studies. So please don't hesitate to get in touch afterwards. I will remind you again. So today is about looking at local civic action and climate emergency being declared at a local level, and how do you actually move in reality once you've decided to make that decision. I thought it'd be interesting to point out we've done a few case studies on wider movements at different levels. We did a case study back in March looking at the Fridays for the Future movement, the youth movement globally, headed by the amazing Greta Thunberg, and looking at it right from the beginning, the one young girl outside a Swedish parliament through to the point where over 130 countries were involved in demonstrations and 25,000 scientists were supporting them, which is quite remarkable. When you think of the actual short time frame which that happened, it really does show that change can happen very quickly. The second movement we looked at, which was in October, we looked back on again at 1 year of Extinction Rebellion. And that was looking from October 2018, when they started with the launch, through to the first uprising in April this year, and then through to October. And again, looking at in 1 year, how you might mobilise, inspire, change the debate around certain issues. Particularly interesting how Extinction Rebellion have done that internally, and particularly interesting to see the current debate and change inside the organisation with the recent comments by one of the founders, which have been taken to be anti-Semitic. So it's very interesting to see an organisation like that grow and morph and change and see how people respond to it. And we also did in March, we did a feature on local civic action and the growth of climate declarations themselves across the world. So the town of Mahuntleth in Wales declared a climate emergency in late 2018. And in mid 2018, and within 3 months of that, 40 other jurisdictions had signed the pledge, a similar pledge, and that actually represented over 17 million people in the UK and 34 million people across the world. So within 3 months, an enormous shift had taken place by people taking that action. We also, in that case study, look at the C40 group, the Cities for Climate Leadership Group, and the Global Covenant of Mayors for Climate and Emergency. And that's interesting too, because it's an example where at the city level, action has been taken out of sort of frustration of lack of action being taken at a national level. So it is possible to take action at lots of different levels, and some of those different levels happen at the same time, of course. I'd like to mention a few areas that we cover. Subject areas. So one of the areas that's really important for most local declarations is transport. It really affects people at the city and county, very local level. We've done a case study on the rise of electric buses So that was a particularly rapid transition. So you see the first electric buses coming online in Shenzhen in China in 2009, and very, very quickly getting up to enormous numbers. So now the whole city's bus system is running on electricity, about 16,500 vehicles. And China is, when we did the case study, it was adding every 5 weeks about 9,500 electric buses, which is about the same number of buses in the whole of the City of London. And it was adding that number of electric buses every 5 weeks. So there's an estimate that by 2030, 84% of buses in the world will be running on electricity, which will make an enormous difference to emissions. And we also had a case study very recently on traffic evaporation, which is a very interesting idea. The idea being that it comes from a study that was done in the UK in 1998, published in 1998, looked at 100 different locations. And it's about, if you reduce the amount of space available to private cars specifically, so that's road space and also parking spaces in some cases, you do actually get a reduction in the overall amount of traffic, about 25%. And it's called traffic evaporation because it's almost like we don't really know where the rest of the traffic goes to. It just disappears. Some of the traffic, you would imagine that if you close a road, most of the traffic is pushed into the areas immediately around that. But what seems to happen is a lot of people change their mode of transport and decide not to drive and go onto public transport or walk. So that was a really interesting example. Obviously, city level infrastructure is very important when you're looking at rapid transition and things that we can do at the city level. One of the, I suppose, in some countries, seems a straightforward and simple way to change is to move to cycling. And it's not easy in all places, because obviously some places are very hilly and some places have very small roads and you can't, it's not suitable for cars and cycles at the same time. However, there is a lovely stat on that if we all were to cycle as much as the Danes, so people in Denmark, do, then we'll be able to reduce European emissions by a quarter. So I think that's quite a nice number. Also, of course, you get the health benefits. That doesn't add into it, you know, what you're actually doing for yourself by cycling. And just a couple of examples that are about legal changes, because regulation does make a difference. And one of them is regulation sort of from above, but at city level. That was here in London. We wrote about it in January. It's London's ultra low emission zone, which came in from April, and was a direct attempt to reduce the impact of diesel cars and therefore particulates in the air. And there's a great quote in there: air pollution is the new tobacco. You know, it is really the issue in lots and lots of cities around the world, not just in London. And, you know, pricing is one of the ways in which you can attempt to move things, but also areas where you simply ban diesel, old diesel vehicles is something that a lot of cities are looking at. I think poor air quality is going to be a major driver of lots of city initiatives in the future. In London, it's estimated 9,500 people in London die annually as a result of poor air quality, you know, which is quite staggering. And unfortunately, we did this to ourselves from 2001, there was a direct incentive to reduce CO2 by encouraging diesel vehicles. And by 2015, a third of all cars in the UK were diesel. So we did it to ourselves and we've had to undo it. The last example is just to look at something that happened very specifically, but I just found it fascinating and I hope that readers do. And it came in from one of our alliance members, Stand Earth, in the US. And they have they brought to our attention an example of a county which is the most northern county on the border with Canada, between Canada and the US, in Washington State, and called Whatcom County. And they basically it's a very beautiful place, but it's a place that has a very undeveloped, enormous port. And there was a possibility there that fossil fuel companies wanted to put major infrastructure there in order to ship oil and gas south down the west coast of the US. And local people, together with the environmental organization Stand Earth, got together and used local laws to first of all block this, and then actually to create a local ordinance to prevent future fossil fuel infrastructure being built. And the basis they used was partly on guarding the health of local people, which I just think is very clever. And also it's fascinating to see how a tiny county with, I think, a council of 7 people have managed to do this. And this is the kind of example that is replicable in lots of places where if you do have a strong local legal system. So that just gives you an overview of where we are. We cover the areas of money, housing, nature, natural world, world of work, energy, food. So if you have an idea for a case study, please do get in touch. That would be brilliant. I would encourage you to share the case studies. If you read something and you think it's good, please pass it on. It makes a big difference and it might inspire someone else to follow the idea. And if you have a comment on what we're doing and you'd like to write something in response to it, we do take blogs as well. Lovely. I will now shut up and hand over to, Andrew, to take us back to the next speaker. Thanks.
Fantastic. Thanks, Nikki, very much. That gave a really, really good flavour. I'm going to move straight on now to Professor Paul Chatterton. He's based at the Geography Department at Leeds University, but also long-term activist and social entrepreneur and innovator, being closely involved with the Lilac housing of zero carbon housing development in Leeds, and has been thinking big about what has to happen at a small local level. So I'll hand over to you, Paul.
Thank you very much, Andy. So here I am. So first thing I must say is welcome to my digital picket line, because I'm, as many of you might know, the university sector is on strike. This is our last day of the UCU strike for pensions and equal pay. So I'm here representing a broader civic group called Our Future Leeds, rather than in my work capacities. So, but I think it's nice to foreground that, because worker solidarity and workplace organising, I think, is absolutely at the heart of rapid transition. So one of the things I'll be speaking about today is really that the key role of solidarity and justice in this. So it's a nice segue, rather than just saying I'm on strike. And also here I am in my living room. This is the award-winning Lilac Grove. So what you see around me in my house, I'm sat in a straw bale house. So the house that I'm sat in has naturally sequestered 37 tons of CO2 in the straw and timber that the house is made from. So a living representation of what we did 6 years ago now, building a zero carbon community. 65% of journeys in Lilac are made by bike. So if the whole world was like Lilac, we would be twice as good as Copenhagen or Amsterdam already. And we're in the middle of West Leeds with the horror of one of the worst transit systems in Europe. Just shows what can be done by the power of great examples. So what I'm going to be talking about in the next 5-10 minutes is just some of the stuff from my book, Unlocking Sustainable Cities, where I try to cast the net a bit wider to say, look, what are we really up against? How do we, this twin dynamic of unlocking these magical, beautiful examples of a better world, but at the same time, the dirtier task of locking down what harms. Now, I want to start by saying we've got a problem, because we don't know two things. We don't know how to think like a city, and we don't know how to think like an emergency. And that's two interesting problems we need to overcome. We don't know how to think like a city because what we're coming up with is isolated, silo, technical and financial elements of the solution, rather than thinking holistically and metabolically or organically. Like, what is a city? What is, in essence, city life? I don't want to get kind of philosophical about this, but what is city life? What makes it tick? What are the different elements, the different system elements that come together to allow us to define this thing called a city, right? And I think we need to put that in a broader context of the city as an industrial or capital accumulating machine, right? And the lifestyles that go with that. And if we don't understand that, we're going to start picking off and underwhelming ourselves with responses which are not to the challenge. And thinking like an emergency. Imagine if this was a civil emergency. You know, we'd open the local sports centre. We'd all rush down there for a flashlight and a tin of Spam, right? So we're not reconfiguring our urban space and our urban public discourses like it really is an emergency. So that is a problem. We have to move, as Greta tells us, that it's no longer good enough to do our best. We're all doing our best. So you sit in meetings with policymakers, they feel terribly attacked. And I say to them, look, you are absolutely doing your best. What you're doing is fantastic. But our best is no longer good enough. We have to do the impossible. And in cities, we have to do the urban impossible. We have to do the transport impossible. Yeah, we have to do the policy impossible. And that is the key challenge for our policymakers. Yes, continue doing your best, but we have to do the impossible. So I've been doing a lot of work in Leeds, especially with, we've got Leeds Climate Commission, which is doing some great stuff in articulating what the exact challenge is here, right? So I'm just going to say there's a couple of pictures I want to show you, really. I just want to share a picture with you. Can you all kind of see that graph, yeah? So this is the kind of, what Leeds Climate Commission, we can see this, yeah? Is it all working, yeah? Great. So there's a typical kind of carbon descent map. You can see, you know, so Leeds emits about 4 million tonnes a year, yeah? Right, of CO2 from different sectors, transport, mainly transport, housing, bit of industry, yeah? And we need to get to zero at the bottom there by, you know, mid-2030s, something like that. So the interesting thing is, the little red shape is we've got a budget in Leeds, 42 million tonnes, right? And that's just our proportion of the global budget. And that's this what we call the safe budget. You know, we can only emit 42 million tonnes in Leeds to hold global temperature rises to 1.5 degrees. And that's a local challenge, part of the world challenge. But the hatched bit, that's the bit we can't use. That's our carbon detox, yeah? So the 4 million tonnes is all the kind of production, what we call territorial emissions, stuff we do in Leeds, yeah? So carbon emissions from Leeds, from the tailpipe of cars, from leaky homes, that kind of stuff, from industry. But here's the interesting challenge. If we add shopping, invisible imported carbon and aviation, we don't emit 4 million tonnes a year, we emit 11 million tonnes a year. So the descent curve is super steep, right? It's still a 42 million ton budget, but the descent curve is absolutely massive. So what we have to do, one of the key principles to build a realistic zero carbon action plan in any particular given locality is firstly, as Extinction Rebellion tell us, is to tell the truth about the scale of the emissions, right? It's normally about double what we expect because of the invisible imported carbon. Absolutely everything we depend upon for daily life is somehow imported into our cities, yeah? Plus aviation, which we don't have to count within city accounting methodologies at the moment. So the scale is twice as big, yeah? So what I'm saying is we can talk about four carbon baddies, right, within cities. And this is where we need to take really radical, quick action. And I'm really into big, quick wins because we've got this 10-year descent curve. So it's no point in planning stuff which starts in 2030. They are not part of emergency planning, right? They're part of long-term planning, not emergency planning. So typically in Leeds, the four carbon bodies, as I put it, these could be rolled out across most cities or most localities across Britain with some you know small adjustments. But certainly homes are the big challenge. Typically, at least a quarter of the story, just leaky homes, yeah? The car-based transport is a significant one, especially motorways and pass-through emissions if you've got motorways in your locality, but the A-roads. They're a complete lock-in to fossil fuel, private-based transport. One of the big things I do in my book is talk about, you know, how we move towards the car-free, the car-light city really rapidly. And then the shopping challenge, you know, the stuff that reproduces our daily life in cities. And aviation, you know, I think what we're starting to see is this delegitimization of aviation and cities starting to take on their airports. And I think we'll see that over the next 10 years. So we need to convert each of these into a credible, beautiful story about what cities or localities look like in 2030. So these carbon baddies turn into zero carbon beauties, yeah? And that's the challenge. So for the housing, right, it would be... I've got some further slides down here. So the first action is the car light city. So we need to radically lock down car culture and aviation growth, yeah? And unlock zero carbon mobility. What I would do is a quick win, and here's something which we're lobbying for, right? I'm just going to show you a website. Is this? So can you all see this? This is Our Future Leeds. We're doing an event. We're doing an event next week. What we're saying is, look, how do we get a lot of people out of their cars really quickly? Well, you can't do it the Macron way, which is you get the gilets jaunes. You can't take without giving back. So look, we are going to have to say the majority of people, apart from those with mobility issues or for emergency reasons or specific job reasons, massive amount of people are going to have to get out of their cars, but you give back through, I call it the kind of like, you know, it's the triple beauty here. It's free publicly owned electric bus companies, right? And we have to go for the big one. And this can be rolled out straight away. This is a matter of politics and political organizing and financial underpinnings through things like workplace parking levy and congestion charge. So yes, you will not be able to drive your cars like you have, but you have a free public bus company. What we have in Britain, we have no idea what a good bus company is. Imagine if a bus was everywhere all the time and it was free, right? That would be a bus service. At the moment, we have this weird thing we call a bus service. Maybe a bus will turn up. It'll cost £3. That's not a bus. That's just some kind of weird thing we call a bus service. Free, publicly owned, electric. That's the way to go. We can do it next year, and that will get 40 or 50% of journeys shifted from cars to buses straight away. That's the kind of ambition that I think we need for transport, yeah? And that's an example of a big idea from my book, and there's lots more like it. The active travel thing, walking and cycling, is a no-brainer, which needs to come in at 30 or 40% of journey straight away. I would mass allocate, once people are into buses, I would mass allocate at least 50% of road space in any locality to mass walking and cycling, yeah? And this is the kind of stuff we need to do now. We need the Green New Deal to back this up in a really big way. Second one, very briefly, is a big zero carbon retrofit. It's home, street by street retrofit, right? Street by street, not a pepper pot approach. So keeping all the different tenure types together, this street, this street, this street. In Leeds, we have to do about one home a minute. I think if you calibrate the numbers, I think we have to retrofit one home a second, right? For the next 10 years, one a second for the next 10 years. Right, so that's the kind of challenge. So it's gearing up massively. Every college of building becomes a college of retrofit, right? And we just do it street by street. This is going to need masses of new civic finance through macroeconomic stimulus at the national level into city green bonds, 10 billion per pot per city region, right? This is a big deal, but it's street by street. And then the mass renewal of green and public spaces, right, which will deal with the nature emergency, but also creating beautiful places for us to live will change our travel habits and especially our aviation habits, right? And it will start to build a local economy based around local services, which will start to respond to that mass importation of carbon, yeah? And then the fourth one is really what I call this new city commonwealth deal, yeah? So a new city commonwealth. Because only by creating new kinds of localized economies, which we've all been talking about now for absolutely decades, will we start to localize supply chains and significantly reduce carbon in our localities. So those are the four zero carbon beauties for me, which replace the zero carbon baddies. And there's a whole bunch of things that we do to get there, including what we've done in Leeds is this Leeds climate change citizens jury, which Andy was one of the commentators at. So do Google it. You'll see it on the Leeds climate change. I will just share my screen again because I wanted to show you the website. These are the recommendations. They came up with 12 of them. Yeah, on Leeds climate. .org.uk, you can see these. I'll share this web link. But they came up with 12, they went through a process of education over 9 evenings, right? And they came up with 12 recommendations. The first one was this focus on transport, call for bus provision to be brought under public control. Hey, and they came up with that after a process of citizen-led popular education, which is fantastic, yeah? I would say we need a network of climate emergency hubs in every neighborhood within urban areas, right? And those hubs create a focus for training, learning, education, outreach, collaboration, prototyping examples, probably a bit like what Paul Allen's doing at CAT with the Zero Carbon Innovation Hub, yeah? We need the Green New Deal, which is nationally, but that needs to have Green New City Deal, so we build the infrastructure around that. And by the way, I must say there's some great stuff going on in Leeds because we've got the Leeds Climate Commission, but the City Council in Leeds has really started to take this on. We need a new kind of politics and they're starting to understand this. So my colleagues at Leeds City Council are doing a great job. They set up a climate emergency advisory committee within the council. You can email climateemergency@leeds.gov.uk. Imagine a year ago, that would be, you know, normally it's kind of like refuse collection at leeds.gov.uk, but they've got a climate emergency email. Imagine a year ago if you said to the leader of Leeds City Council, you're going to have to create a climate emergency email. they would have no idea what you were talking about. 12 months later, we have this real institutional innovation going on. And I think I'll end by saying, we've got to build in climate justice, this new kind of politics and climate justice, real climate justice, making our yardstick of success how we have responded to the most vulnerable in our localities. So going to the most vulnerable and saying, how has this worked for you? And that is our yardstick of success. It must be, because what we're seeing as climate emergency responses emerge is a little bit of a consultant free-for-all emerging. Lots of people pitching in saying, I've got a great solution for you. So this is everything from the big management consultants down to grassroots organisations saying, this is what you need to do. So you talk to a climate emergency local authority officer and they're getting reports on their desk every week about what to do, and they're getting lobbied from left, right and centre. It's a really fascinating process. So we see two things here. On one side, there's the kind of degrowth steady state lobby saying it's all about local economics, it's all about degrowth. On this side, there's a lot of people pushing the Naomi Klein shock doctrine on this, that this is a new avenue for capital accumulation. They've realized that responding to the climate emergency means money, right? So we are seeing two significant trends here, and I want you to all be alive to those trends, because if we go with the shock doctrine, capital accumulation route, we will lock ourselves into the problems that got us into this, solutions that got us into this problem in the first place. The final comment I've got is that we might not well make this. You know, we may hold global temperatures 1.5 degrees, but that's not really down to what we do in the UK. So what we need to do anyway, as we're doing this stuff, is to make our communities as resilient and as safe as possible in the likely event that things are going to get rocky ahead. So it's not just about having beautiful places, but it's having safe places. And I think we're at an amazing political moment in the UK where everybody needs to look at the manifestos in front of them and say, which will guarantee us a safe future? Because we're at this amazing junction now where we've got a choice as a nation between choosing a safe future and an unsafe future. I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Fantastic, Paul. That's you. I think we've just heard from a one-person northern powerhouse. Not just the kind of the imagination and the creativity, but the will to drive it through. And I have to say that from my own experience of the citizens' jury that was run by the Leeds Climate Commission, it was an exemplary process and really energizing to be even just to be part of, even just to kind of contribute information to. And I very much hope I can see it becoming a kind of a template for being replicated in a lot of other places. In an interesting sort of reflection on your comment about the people seeking to sort of profit from the moment, the shock doctrine sort of aspect to it, and the Wall Street Journal actually published in a profit apocalypse. Joking, really weren't being ironic either. So we also know what we're up against. And on that very small bombshell, I see Catriona is with us. So I'm going to now mute myself and hand over to Catriona Curry, who is leading the work at Friends of the Earth to coordinate and energize action at the local level. Over to you, Catriona.
Hi, thanks for having me. Yeah, it's hard to act to follow Paul, but I'll try my best. So yes, I'm Kat. I work at Friends of the Earth as a senior campaign activism advisor. I co-lead our climate campaign, and my specific focus is on our grassroots activism. So I'm going to be talking a bit more about the activism side of things and how we can mobilise and organise our grassroots. So I suppose just in terms of context, we've kind of already covered some of it, but obviously we all are highly aware that climate is higher up the agenda than ever, thanks to, of course, the youth strikers, Extinction Rebellion, but also many more organisers as well. We've seen obviously a huge surge of people wanting to take climate action, and obviously we've also seen this soar over the past year of hundreds of councils declaring climate emergencies. So kind of core to our theory of change is that we've seen that people want to do more than sign a petition. They want to be asked to do something that feels commensurate with the scale of the problem. And we've also seen like a huge opportunity for local action to really translate at the moment in terms of real change at both the local and the national level. So back in April this year, Friends of the Earth, Friends of the Earth, we launched a what we call Climate Action, which is a new network of community groups across England, Wales and Northern Ireland fighting for climate justice where they live. So I'm just going to talk you through kind of like how it works and kind of our kind of key steps of how we organize at the local level, and then I'll go on to a little bit about how we do this and what those groups are pushing for. So it generally happens a little bit like this. First, we find local leaders in the community. So these can be people who are already involved in community action or someone who's kind of stepped forwards. Ideally, it's someone actually that's never been involved in something like this before, who's kind of brand new to community activism. We then support them to run a kickoff event in their community. So it's an event which brings together people in the local community to talk about climate change, talk about their fears and their hopes, and also to start beginning to talk about what they could do together. And at the end of the event, we ask, it's kind of a nervous time, and we ask people to stand up and commit to leading the group, which is kind of a bit of a time where you have to be comfortable with awkward silences for a while and just sit in the awkward. And then eventually, at least one people, usually more two, three, four people will stand up and say, yes, we're going to lead this group. And everyone gives them a massive round of applause. We're all super excited. And then we ask the remainder of the people in the room to join the group and to there and then commit to joining that group. Then we kind of work with the group to introduce them to our core campaign, which at the moment is to get councils to commit to and adopt an ambitious climate action plan for their council. So the idea with this kind of what we call a network change campaign is that we have this kind of central ask, which all groups work towards, but then they can have the flexibility to adapt it to their local area. So for example, they can adapt it to, they can push certain elements in their area that might be more important for them. They can decide how they want to organize their group, but kind of all groups are working towards this kind of shared and common goal, which we've seen has been quite motivating. We then have a regional campaign organizer who provides kind of on the ground support to the group, which is backed up by central resources that we provide, which I'll come on to later, but includes kind of things like webinars, communication channels, but I'll come back to some of those and what they look like. I suppose it's important to say that central to our theory of change is that we see councils as allies in this. We see councils adopting climate action plans as a kind of stepping stone towards the UK government implementing their own climate action plan. Obviously, we know it's so important for councils to be cutting their carbon, but we also know that the UK government holds a huge amount of the levers. So we essentially, what we want to do through this is tell the story of communities and councils kind of up and down the country taking climate action seriously and kind of starting from the grassroots and I suppose in raising the pressure on the UK government to follow suit and do the same. At the same time as the groups are kind of lobbying at the local level, we're also providing opportunities for them to connect to lobby at the national level as well, which we've already seen happen during this election campaign, where we've had groups putting on local hustings and pressuring their campaign, their candidates to take a kind of central climate pledge and to really get information from them where they stand on key climate issues. So just to go back to some of the tools that we've got, which I can share with you in the chat box after this. So most of our tools are on our website called takeclimateaction.uk. It's got lots of resources on there, but also a map of where all our groups are. One of the key resources that we're organising around is our Climate Action Plan for Councils, which is a 50-point plan of concrete policies which councils can introduce to cut their carbon. We've got it kind of in a Word version, so it's editable by local communities, so they can edit it to suit their local context. We've also got a postcode lookup tool, is what we're calling it. So essentially, you can enter your postcode and see how climate friendly your area is based on kind of a range of climate related statistics. So, for example, percentage of tree cover in your area, percentage of people who commute on bike, there's various different factors. Our data wizards have pulled lots of data from various different official government sources, but it's, you know, it's not 100%, you know, I'm sure there are slight errors in it, but it shows a general picture of the area. It's also important to say that obviously the council doesn't control every single element in a local area, but it's kind of a good starting point we found for our groups to kind of see what the priorities could be within their council. We've also got various guides on kind of breaking down local climate policy for people. Just to say, I suppose, that a lot of the people we're seeing getting involved in climate action have never done anything like this before. Neither they've not campaigned, but they also haven't been working on climate change stuff. So it's really important for us to try and help break both kind of the campaigning skills down, but also the kind of climate policy, because we all know it can get a bit complicated and wonky. We need to make sure that we're really breaking that down. A few of the kind of tools we use for organising is that we use Slack. I don't know if anyone else does, but we use it for our activists. We have kind of a workspace. It's a bit of a learning curve of making sure that everyone can use it and get onto it, but we're finding it quite helpful. We also run regular webinars for people, kind of both on campaigning skills and climate issues and knowledge areas they need to succeed. I suppose just finally, just to say that we launched this back in April, and we now have 137 groups across England, Wales, Northern Ireland. Just to break that down a little bit, 40% of those groups are brand new groups, so ones that we've kind of done that kickoff event with and started and set up brand new. 30% of them are Friends of the Earth local groups who have kind of signed up to the campaign or are doing more outreach in the local community. And then 30% of them are actually other community groups that have signed up to the network. So that might be existing fracking groups or transition town groups. Essentially, they see the benefit of signing up so they can have access to the resources and support and feel like they're part of something bigger. I think it's fair to say we haven't seen like huge concrete wins yet in terms of council policy changes, because obviously things take time and these groups are really just kind of getting going and setting up. But we have seen kind of really strong conversations starting. And we're hopeful of seeing councils adopt some concrete climate action plans soon, or adapt the ones that they already have. This is a key thing that we're trying to work on, and actually be really interesting to see if anyone else already has this, is some sort of tool to help us track councils, kind of the national picture of what they're working on, what they're committing to, and to seeing kind of the national trend, I suppose, both in terms of kind of holding them to account, but also to be able to tell that story of kind of councils taking the lead, hopefully if that is the real story. I think I'll leave it there, but yeah, thanks for inviting me on.
Katrina, thank you so much. And I think it sounds incredibly impressive in that short period of time to have over 130 groups, and a substantial number of those being entirely new ones as well. Incredible. It begins to give you kind of an intimation of the flavour of picking up on Paul's point about do we know what it means to think like we're in a climate emergency? And when you start to see things like that happening, it's incredibly encouraging, even if we do have to kind of ramp it up even further. But I think what we'll do now is jump ahead to questions from people, for which I'm going to hand over to my colleague Peter, who's going to pick up on any questions we've already had and invite further questions from you, and we'll take it from there. So handing over to you, Peter.
Great, thanks very much. Yeah, we've had a few questions in. I'll just run through them and then perhaps people can pick up on those that they feel best placed to respond to. So one question we had in advance was from Poppy, who said, the youth strikes have been hugely inspiring and influential in bringing the climate emergency into the foreground, but it's still a relatively small number of young people involved. What suggestions do the panel have for encouraging local authorities that they need to think beyond emissions reductions and include developing how educational institutions teach for the future if we're going to have a socially accepted and just transition? This needs to go far beyond teaching the facts of climate change at primary and secondary level. I'd be interested to hear of any good case studies or evidence the panel knows about. So a question about education there. Nikki posed the question about whether rural living is unsustainable, and I think Paul already responded to that partly, but we can put that one on the table. And then Julie was asking about the practicalities of citizens' assembly. She'd like to do one in Hastings, but it's hard to get buy-in from the council and the funding. And there were I think, again, Paul shared some ideas there. So maybe, Paul, I don't know if you want to speak to those last two points about rural living and funding for citizens' assemblies, and then we can throw the education question open to everyone.
Yeah, great. I think I just covered it there, really, that rural living is deeply unsustainable, just as city living is. But I think it's because we don't have a climate emergency spatial plan, national spatial plan. And I think that's what we need. And that will... We can't see the rural and the city as separate, yeah? So we need like a new spatial planning framework, where we identify rural areas and connect them well with sustainable transport and jobs. So we haven't really done that. You know, we've got this kind of 1945 planning system, this kind of weird attachment to green belts. I'm not suggesting this is a developer free-for-all, but, you know, we need to take a good look at our spatial plan. That's the rural thing. And the other one was, what was the other one? Sorry, what was the other one?
So there was the one then about the resourcing for citizens' assemblies locally. Interested in one in Hastings.
And I've shared a web link with Shared Future and Peter Bryant, who convenes that process. Well, the one that we used. Obviously, there are other organisations that do that, but you could always contact Peter and his team. Obviously, they're a small social enterprise, but they're gearing up rapidly to deliver this. They're creating a template through some funding from the UK Research Council's, the PCAMP, the Place-Based Climate Action Network, to create a template for how you could do this in local authorities. There is a price tag. I mean, the deep dive approach, which we did in Leeds, is, you know, 20, 30 grand. So you can't do this on the cheap. That's the key lesson from us. But we are creating, we have trailblazed it in Leeds and laid down a lot of templates, yeah? On the education one, I'm just going to send a link around because we've just set up this group called Geographers for Life, and we're doing a climate flash poll for young people. And we've, through that, I've connected with some amazing geography teachers around the world, around the country, who are developing a climate curriculum. So there's loads happening out there. So I'm going to share that climate flash poll now. And if you could get, we've got over 1,000 young people that have already done it. You get more and more people to, young people to fill that in, then that'd be great. And I think structurally what we need to do is get young people on the decision-making boards of as many statutory organisations as possible. And I don't mean tokenistically. I mean young people making major financial and infrastructure decisions. What I'm saying to adults is, no longer is it legitimate to make any decision within a city, within a locality, if you do not have a representation, a significant empowering representation of young people on a decision-making body. Not one single infrastructure and spending decision can be made in a meeting without a young person present. That's what I want to see tomorrow.
Great, thanks very much, Paul. Anyone else want to come in on this question of education or resourcing for citizens' assemblies? If not, I'll ask Nikki to say a bit more about why she would raise that question about sustainable rural living, or whether rural living is currently unsustainable. But I'll throw it open to anyone else first of all. Anyone else want to come in on the point about education or resourcing for citizens' assemblies?
Actually, Peter, can I say something quickly about that?
Yeah, okay, you come in, Nikki. Yeah.
Only because I've been involved, I'm thinking about several people locally who've asked me about this, about the resourcing for, you know, doing this sort of climate work here. And again, it's harder in smaller places because getting access to £20,000 in a small community is that much harder than it is in a city environment. So sometimes these scales are really important. I really love the idea of, you know, having proper national spatial planning, but I have to say I'm not holding my breath on that one. So I think it's vital that we learn from each other wherever we can. So I think that's one of the things I've learned through the case study mechanism. If it's sort of good enough, up to date, it's smart enough, it really can be helpful to learn. I've had a look on the website from the FOE website, and I'm immediately thinking of who to plug into that. So I think the sort of sideways networking in lots of these examples, I think that will be really vital. So there's the national stuff, and then there's also the just get on and do what you can do now at the same time as feeding into that national policy decision making, I think is really vital. And it gives something, people, I think Catriona mentioned that as well, the idea of needing something to actually do. Lots of very, very capable people all over our country in all different age groups and all different communities, and we need to, you know, just get up and start doing stuff.
Yeah, perhaps I can just sort of abuse my position as chair of this discussion just to come in on the Brighton experience, because what we're finding at the moment is there's this sort of back and forth between us trying to get groups excited and engaged with this, but the council wanting to set some parameters around what's up for discussion, like the terms of reference, because they're worried that people will come in with lots of ideas that are really about national policy and not about things they have control over. So insofar as, you know, some decision-making around transport or energy or, you know, sourcing of food and procurement and those sorts of things are not within their direct control, they're anxious, you know, not to be the target of demands around those sorts of things. So there's this back and forth between what are the terms of reference, what's the scope of a citizens' assembly, how much of this will be generating demands that just get passed straight up nationally as opposed to locally. So I think it's an important issue about where the authority lies to take these sort of key decisions. Anyone else want to come in on practicalities of citizens' assemblies or those other points about rural sustainability or education? Just unmute yourself if you want to jump in.
Peter, if no one else is there at the moment, just on the rural sustainability issue, I just see a lot of people turning up in the West Country thinking that they're doing a green thing, and then they spend their lives in their cars driving their children to school. So it is really important that there's some sort of connectivity in that. I think the rural population, or people who count themselves as rural in the UK, is only 17 million people. So it is still it's important to realise we are an urbanised society, but it's just an issue that isn't really discussed as if it's some kind of clean idyll out here. It isn't. And then on top of that, you've got commercial farming and, you know, other, and we see the you know, to be honest, you've got more wildlife in cities now than we have in the countryside. So there are some serious issues, and it's definitely not joined up. So it's really important that it's not spoken about in a way as two different places.
Yeah, no, and I very much liked Paul's idea about free publicly owned electric buses. That would be a key thing where I live as well, because we just have, you know, weekends, there's hardly any buses at all. I'm sure it's the same where you are.
And just to say, in the interview, because somebody mentioned
something. So it's absolutely crucial. Sorry, was trying to come in there?
Sorry, just to say, in the interim, people have mentioned on chat about steps towards free buses. I mean, one of the key things there is refranchising services. So local authorities do, the devolved areas do have powers over refranchising. So what we need to see is Transport for London style powers, where you basically deprivatise the market. So you force the likes of Stagecoach, Arriva and First Bus to work together to create a unified comprehensive service. But it does cost a lot of money. I know that Liverpool and Manchester are going, and Sheffield are going through this process now, and it does have a price tag to it. And so there needs to be national policy and finance there.
Hi, could I chip in a second?
Yes, please do.
Hi, my name is Richard Joy. First of all, I'd like to say thanks for organising an absolutely brilliant webinar. I just found the whole thing fascinating. Immediate points that strike me is the work that a lot of you guys have been doing. I mean, I'm interested in this space, you know, for the last few years, and either I've been looking in the wrong places or just haven't been getting the right messages. But the best practice of what you're doing in your approaches and working with these citizen assemblies is just phenomenal. The pace of change, the speed at which things have got to happen, there needs to be some kind of standardization of what are the approaches for doing this. I don't know what you might be doing on that, but this needs to be cascaded so quickly. I think there's a latent group of people who would just support this so well. And the third point I'd just like to make, if anyone's interested in things that are happening in the Bay Area around San Francisco, I was out there a couple of months ago. My father's out there, he's an activist, and they've got something, climate emergency mobilization, where they have engaged with, I think there's over 100 town and city councils out in the Bay Area. And they're bringing representatives of a large proportion of those together with some business people, but a lot of activists and some relevant politicians to actually get them to consider what are the implications for the Bay Area. If the sea levels go up, you know, a million people get their feet wet. But I'll happy to follow up if anyone wants any information on that at some point.
Great, thanks very much. There's sort of two points in there. One is around standardisation, whether we've got common ideas around toolkits and what works and so on. So I'm wondering whether Katrina might come back in on that one. There's also a question come in from Ronnie asking about planning and where planning fits into all of this. And my sense is that planning is central, but someone else might want to kick in, come back to that one. So Katrina, if you're still there, are you able to take on the one about standardization, sharing of resources, toolkits, that type of thing, because I think that's what FOE's trying to do, right?
Yeah,
we're trying to standardize in terms of the climate action plan for councils. I think we found that our activists have found it really helpful to have one kind of document which they can then adapt, both in terms of, like, you know, they're not climate experts, so they want, you know, they want us to set it out for them, but also in terms of being able to feel like they're part of something bigger and pushing for something that someone else on the other side of the country is pushing for as well. But I suppose to say, I mean, I think we always struggle with this in the movement, right? We're all developing different things in different places, and I think as much as we're trying to bring some stuff together, there's so much more out there. I think though it can be a bit overwhelming for activists as well, if we've got so many different versions, so I suppose it's just whatever works for them. But I think these sorts of webinars are bringing together people to share their resources. It's really helped for me. I've already seen a few that I've not seen before.
Can I bring in Julia at this point, because she's posed the question around housing standards, which I guess relates a little bit to the planning discussion that a few people have been asking about online. Julia, do you want to come in and explain your question?
Yeah, I mean, there's a combination of things. So in Hastings, we're not there's not quite as many houses planned as nearby estate, nearby councils, but there's 180 actually being planned on a floodplain. they're meant to be doing something about that, but. So bedding in the highest building standards, but also stuff like they're not thinking about putting in microgrids. You know, I'm part of a community energy co-op, having community owned, you know, there's really good models like in Nottingham and places, but they're scared of, it's still a bit on the edge of it's not a standard practice yet. So how you encourage councils to be innovative with stuff like that, and getting them to be bold, I suppose, and also with the plan process, making it something that's, I mean, people really engage on walkabouts and stuff like that, but the consultation process is normally just dire. So how, anyone who's got good examples of making that livelier and interesting, because it's really fundamental, everyone needs to be inputting into their local plan, and they're always being reviewed, so there's opportunities all the time.
Great, thanks very much. Any other comments on that around standards, microgrids, consultation processes, ways to make them more interesting and engaging and attractive for citizens to get involved? Anyone got any thoughts on that? Paul, I can see you've got your microphone off. Are you wanting to say something?
There's places around the world that are experimenting with kind of planning carbon budgets, yeah? So I think what we need to see is a rubber stamp on every application now, which, like, what's the lifetime carbon emissions from this development? And then planning officers need to just be brave and just reject them on that basis. And actually, I'd go through the pipeline, because what we've got in Leeds City Region, well, like every other city region, major road capacity infrastructures and volume house developments, which are stacking up. I call them carbon bombs. They're going to detonate in the next 10 years. They just have to be stopped. So I think we need our brave planning officers who are saying, look at the carbon price tag on that. If our locality's got a finite, that's the budget, right? That's it. Once it's gone, it's gone. Well, once it's gone, you're eating somebody else's. So if the carbon budget's too, just like we do on other issues, you know, social justice issues, wildlife issues, conservation issues, if the carbon doesn't stack up, it's out. You know, come back with a zero carbon car-like development, everyone. You all know the horrors. You could all go to your local planning portals and fish out those big volume built planning applications that are just sitting there like carbon bombs waiting to detonate in the next 10 years. How do we possibly just stop all that? You know, we need national policy change. Get your heads in those manifestos in the next few days and have a look what's going on. I mean, this is, you know, this is the emergency moment, right?
There's that bigger issue of like climate proofing everything, really, isn't it? Any, like you're saying, any decision coming through the pipeline, having to check its compatibility with, you know, ever shrinking carbon budgets, but then having proper powers of veto over things which are incompatible, I guess. So some of that will be national, some of it will be local. Yeah. Who else wants to jump? Julia, do you want to jump in on that? You've got your microphone off, I think.
Oh, I was just coming back on the carbon budgets, the slides that I think Paul showed earlier, that it's very easy to find the figures on, you know, there's government figures on the carbon, on the main carbon budget, but on that stuff, that really important stuff about consumption and flying, I just wondered where you found your figures for that in for that Leeds, you know, the graph you showed earlier, because that's really important to highlight to people.
That was a scaling up of national estimates.
Oh,
so
okay.
That doesn't exist locally. So you've got to make assumptions, but it might be under-calibrated for Leeds given how such a reasonable shopping destination it is. Mm. Yeah, at the moment it's just a rescaling of consumption-based emissions.
So you've just divided it by population, sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, you can spend a bit more time doing this. I mean, there is C40 has, you know, greenhouse gas protocol inventory, you know, protocols that you can work through. It's quite a laborious process. But I mean, typically we know that consumption emissions are about double of production emissions. So you can just make those estimates, yeah.
Yeah,
but I mean, we had in the Leeds Climate Commission have done a detailed study of the carbon profile of Leeds Bradford Airport. So you can figure out, you know, you can make estimates, and so you do it through GDP, you do it through spending profiles, consumer indices for retail, and you do it through number of flight passengers for aviation.
Thanks.
So, can I just get an update from Sophie or Andrew about where we're at with Paul's video? Are we still trying to fix that, or are we parking that for now?
I think we're going to upload it to the Rapid Transition website, where it'll be easily viewable, rather than trying to squeeze it through the available bandwidth.
Yeah, I think that's probably best, given there was no sound. Yeah.
Fair enough. So let's keep rolling with this. I can't see any other questions at the moment. Some other suggestions. Andrew referring us to the carbon brief, which has done. Yeah, I've seen that, a good assessment of different party manifestos. This is going back to Paul's point about the need to look at the detail of party manifestos with a view to the election next week. Poppy throwing in another question about education, saying she's surprised learning and training doesn't feature at all in the Friends of the Earth plan. Poppy, do you want to say what the issue is there, and then maybe Katrina could come back on that?
Hi, yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Great, thank you. Thanks so much for an interesting webinar. I'm just sort of curious, partly, I mean, education's my field, I'm working sustainability on various themes in schools, but there doesn't seem to be any emphasis being put on what does education for a climate emergency look like beyond teaching about the facts of climate change. I work in London. Our local authority's got a consultation out at the moment, and as part of their climate emergency resolutions, it does feature teaching about climate change, but they're a long way from working out what that looks like. And with a local group, we're trying to sort of put in suggestions. It's a lot more than just the facts on climate change. It needs to be a whole kind of reorientation of the ethos and values that schools represent and pass on. And it needs to be happening in secondary schools, not just primary schools. It needs to be happening in adult education and training. It doesn't seem to feature in any of the various NGO climate action plans I've looked at so far. So I'm wondering, is it because it's too messy and complicated? We can't put figures and numbers of emission reductions attached to it? Is it because people think it's just too much of a long game and we need to be reducing emissions next week instead of when primary school children are in working age? Interested to hear.
Okay, thanks so much. Katrina, do you want to come up with whether education featured in the FOE work in this area, or anyone else wants to reflect on that question?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really good challenge to us, Poppy. Our climate action plan was put together by our head of policy. I think maybe it was looked at through more of a kind of what will cut carbon quickly, but I think that's a really good challenge. We're going to be looking to do a second version of this climate action plan probably early in the new year, just because obviously we kind of put it out, but we've been getting lots of feedback. So I will just write it down as an action point for me to take back to see whether we could incorporate something like that. I think it's a really good challenge.
Okay, thanks so much. And then we've got a question from Julia again, asking about, has anyone had conversations with their local FE colleges about skilling up students for retrofit, etc.? Is that an area anyone has any experience or expertise they want to throw into the mix?
in Leeds, we've got the Leeds College of Building, which is one of the biggest building colleges in the country. And they've got an amazing apprenticeship scheme. We talked to them about a sustainable construction apprenticeship. They're 100% up for it. But at the moment, the reality they face is that pretty much all the apprenticeships that they generate go into jobs with volume builders. So until there's an economic sector which can employ them, they'd be really hesitant to reformulate their curriculum to sustainable construction. Yeah. So you see the way that there's a dysfunction between what the market wants, because it's dominated by the big volumes, and what the education providers dare provide. Yeah.
So there's also a couple of resources that Paul has shared and Andrew has shared, which people can follow up with afterwards about schools and introducing climate related things into the curriculum. I think the other thing to mention is also universities. I mean, I don't know what Paul thinks of this, but across Sussex, where I work, you often wouldn't get the impression that there's a climate emergency going on in terms of curriculum design and the sorts of issues that feature in, you know, not just economics, but across the board. So I think there's a job for those of us working in academia as well to push that agenda. Switching away from education, if people are all right with that, we can come back to it. But Nikki's also thrown in a question about examples of where planning is working. How we might change the process, what's the best method of change to get there. Anyone want to come back to the issue of planning and any good examples of positive practice? I'm sure Paul has many. but anyone else as well wants to chip in on that?
If not, Paul, is that an example for planning?
Your question was around planning, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yes, it is. Yeah, I just wondered. I thought, you know, I was sitting here after Paul's comment about, you know, getting young people involved, and thinking, you know, that the actual composition of the planning committees, if you go and watch and participate in one of these things, does make you want to blow your own head off. it's disastrous, and you know, sometimes you don't even seem to have people who, you know the specific area they're talking about, and there's certainly no real discussion about sustainability at all. And I don't feel that's really changed very much, you know, having been involved in that sort of thing for quite a long time. I don't think it's, I did for some years run a local building with alternative materials, you know, sustainable building training organization, and we got involved with our local FE college, who was a sort of leader at the time, but it just remained really, really niche. So it was people coming to us who wanted to build a cob oven in their nice garden for the, that wasn't what we wanted to do. We wanted to try to affect change at the training level in the college, and we were always treated a bit like we were just doing a niche thing for a specific group of people. I'm genuinely interested in if there's examples where someone's managed to make that transition and get treated as a real part of a local economy. That's it's brilliant for it will be good for us to share on the site too.
Okay, so anyone know of any radical planners out there or positive examples of planning practice? I mean, your point there about composition, I think, is really important. It might go back to what Paul was saying before about having younger people involved or people with more of a stake in this, and having some sort of veto power over, you know, future planning decisions. But anyone else want to chip in on that, on positive examples of planning, either composition of planning committees or styles of planning? Anyone got positive examples there? If not, share them with us afterwards, and we can share them with others. Okay. So on universities, Paul's talking about the Leeds University climate crisis. We've got lots of universities declaring climate declarations. Andrew shared the thing about the Zero Carbon University Initiative. So these things are coming on. They're coming along now. Likewise, we're trying to develop a sustainable travel policy at our university. But there's a lot of pushback, as you might imagine. What else? So yeah, lots coming in on education still. Julia's just shared something on from the Town Planning Institute. Julia, do you want to talk us?
Yeah, I was just remembering. It's more principles, but it's a very good. I read it a while ago, and I need to go back to it actually. Good guideline in terms of how to make sure that climate change is integrated into your planning system, and it takes you through in a fairly pain-free way the legislation and the fact that there is planning legislation, but there's also the Climate Act legislation, and that they need to be complying with that. So there's a few useful tools in there, which I've just, by talking today, it's reminded me that I need to look at it. So I thought it might be useful for other people. It's like a, it's a really good document, and it's very easy for, yeah, non-planners to understand. Well, I found it quite easy, yeah. So.
Excellent. And I think just going back to what Nikki was saying right at the very start, if people do come across positive examples of where planning has shifted in ways that are sort of, you know, where things speed up and they're more progressive and more in line with what's required, do let us know, because that's the sort of thing we could share through the Alliance as a case study, and hopefully then as an advocacy tool to push other councils in similar directions. So do get in touch if you come across those sorts of things. Richard sharing something on sustainability issues in California. So again, that's there for people's reference. Any other issues that sort of came up earlier in the discussion that we've not given more attention to? We've had quite a bit on transport, on rural issues, education, the practicalities of citizens' assemblies, but are there any issues that were raised by earlier comments or interventions that we need to come back to that we haven't given enough airtime to so far? We've got about 15 minutes left, so we can either wrap up fairly soon or we can move into another area of discussion.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just thinking back to the Paul's slides about the rapid descent and the and wondering if anyone had done anything on that sort of state, you know, that we have to start now sort of thing. So if you're looking at a 10-year descent curve, what's year one look like, I suppose? I'm still getting my head round that, because all these are quite big picture stuff we're talking about, which we desperately need, but everyone's very keen to get going on stuff. Yeah, so any...
Okay, so maybe we can throw that to Paul. What's the first bold move to get the ball rolling? How do you get down the descent curve?
In a town, not a city as well.
Paul, are you still around?
Oh, I think he's had to go, actually. I've just seen.
He's had to go, okay. So Paul's not there. Someone else was waiting to come in.
Yeah, hi.
Yeah.
I was just going to make the point, and again, it picks up on what Paul was saying earlier in his presentation and his, whatever it was, 4 points. I think what was really interesting about that, it was actually presenting a future, of a vision of what a sustainable future might look like. And I think one of the problems is that within, doesn't matter whether it's local government, central government, communities, or, you know, all of us, I think we're just even struggling to think about what could it look like? Because if we don't know where we want to go, we're not going to have a roadmap of how we're going to get there. So I think Paul's contribution on that was fascinating.
Thanks very much. There's another comment coming in about, yeah, the need for, oh, I can't see the comments again now. Yeah, targeted interventions that are appropriate for district councils versus local councils. Again, Katrina's sharing another resources for smaller councils, so hopefully that partly responds to that issue. Andrew, did you want to come back to the issue about sort of positive stories and new narratives? Because I know you've got a line on this about, just coming back to the last intervention, about what that positive change looks and feels like, how we can touch it and imagine it.
Well, I mean, there's a couple of very specific things, I suppose, where a number of issues can kind of come together. The first and most important thing is that from the general work that we've been doing, and one of the original motivations for bringing the Rapid Transition Alliance together, was one of the missing ingredients in achieving change was, it sounds so simple that it's almost intangible, but this notion of believing in the possibility of change. And so one of the reasons for having, building up the evidence based around stories of practical action at various different levels was to allow visualization to be people, to allow people to be able to see the adjacent possibilities of things being very different from where they are now. And I think one of the areas where this is coming together, and it's an area that we're in of sort of a former work incarnation at the New Economics Foundation, we did a lot of work on high streets. And we did a lot of work on high streets because of the kind of the twin dynamics, how in some areas, out-of-town supermarket developments were killing off high streets. So you had the phenomenon of ghost town Britain. And on the other hand, where there was still money circulating, you nevertheless had the encroachment of of chain stores whose local money flows were less positive in terms of the way that money didn't kind of stick and work within the community. It tended to be part of an extractive economic model and left the community. So there is this area about allowing people, if we're trying to now, going back to Paul's point, which I thought was a really brilliant challenge, actually, learning to think like we're in a climate emergency. If we were to pose the question, for example, about how might we reimagine that first point of contact that most of us have with the economy, the high street, how might the high street look and feel different in if we were kind of actively grasping the notion of being in a climate emergency? And I know Paul talked about having climate emergency hubs, for example. But you can imagine that with the growth of more resilient local economies, how a lot of properties, which with a very small sort of tweaks in planning law and laws around vacant properties, how you might throw properties open to have local institutions, whether it's kind of micro market, as kind of the climate emergency, electric or home, et cetera, et cetera. I'm interested, I suppose, in tales and examples where we're beginning to see what the physical difference in your immediate local neighborhood might be, so that you encounter this issue. The thing about making choices and day-to-day choices and making different choices is that we make choices between available possibilities. And if those other adjacent possibilities aren't visible, aren't immediately there and in front of us, it's harder to kind of bring them into the fold. So I'm sort of fascinated by the ways in which we can make this more visible. Now, there's a certain amount that we can do to look at how, you know, the brilliant work of transition towns, or in Latin America, the works of the Buen Vivir movement, for example, all those amazing transformative examples of how some very poor neighborhoods in Latin America were transformed by participatory budgeting, with, you know, very visibly the community coming together to make decisions about the allocation of resources at the local level. I'm also interested in the way in which when we talk about, I think there's a moment is happening now where it's suddenly become valid across the political spectrum to talk about large-scale public investment. Now, that's all well and good at the level of large-scale infrastructure, but in terms of discretionary spending by local authorities, you know, at the local level, I think perhaps there's an opportunity there to ferret out examples where communities themselves have got engaged in decision-making around allocation of resources to meet local community needs in ways which are resilient, building and speak to the low carbon transition model. So I'd be very interested, and I think it's an area that we're probably going to try and look at a lot more, about how we can make this whole process very visible in the very immediate local level. So that, I mean, just walking around my local area in South London today, I can see some enterprising Extinction Rebellion activists have been posting up some beautifully designed agitprop, trying to kind of remind people that it's now, it's here, we're living in the moment of the climate emergency, and we need to be making decisions on the basis of that. And I think one of the things that the Alliance can do, with your help and the help of others, is to make psychologically available these alternatives and tell and find, if we can bring together as many stories where people can kind of visualize the possibilities of how things can be done differently in the here and now, that would be a very good thing. So that's an open-hearted invitation to have the conversation. If you don't know things off the top of your head, tap up friends, talk to them about it, ask them of things that they've seen and they know. Because very often things will happen at the local level very quickly. Emerging, and we need to kind of get the telephone tree and the social media tree going, so that we can kind of bring them together. We can see all those possibilities in one place. That's a quick thought.
Thanks very much, Julie. Did you want to come in? It looks like you've got your microphone off.
I forgot to leave it. I was just busy writing.
Okay, that's okay. Yeah. No, I'm just wondering if anyone has concrete suggestions on how to do that actual work of visualization. So beyond sort of case studies and websites, and you know what does it look like to visualize and imagine that more positive future? Because I think, you know, Andrew's absolutely right. That's the key thing. It's very easy for incumbent actors of one sort or another to represent their world as inevitable and the only one that's viable and affordable. So how do you illustrate the benefits of something which isn't there yet? anyone got sort of concrete? I mean, obviously we could think about cartoons, videos and scenarios and so on, but what's, anyone got thoughts on what that looks like? Because I think it's a key thing. Like, what's, how do you sell a desirable, you know, zero carbon city or neighbourhood that engage people? Sorry, who wanted to?
Sorry, that was Julia. that's, I think car-free days are a really valuable way of doing that, because it's actually about transforming. We had our first one in Hastings. Sadly, the weather was crap, but anyway, the people who came out really enjoyed it on the seafront. And just to physically experience the seafront without the constant noise, and the residents in the, by the evening, people, because by then the weather cleared a bit, they were having their tea street, using it like their front yard. That sort of stuff that's actually an experience for the day. It still took a hell of a lot of organising, but on a small scale, you know, doing play streets, I really want to see more of those in Hastings, because that should be relatively easy to do. And it's sort of demonstrating on a, you know, like temporary interventions, I think, like that can be really transformative for people and not too difficult to do.
Yeah, so those reclaiming spaces, experiential things like that, I think are fantastic, so people actually get a feel for what it's like to breathe decent air again, not have cars crowding out everything else. So that's a really good idea. Anyone else, any other thoughts on the sort of actual visualisation, making it more tangible?
So one of the things I thought about, and it's really sort of how you go about doing that, is just that we don't often enough collaborate with people in the creative world and ask their help for this, because they're the people who are good at communicating complex issues in a simple way. And sometimes the art around this topic is quite cheesy, to be brutal. And we've got brilliant, you know, creative industry in the UK, and we don't really ask them often enough or use them. And I know you can pay a lot of money for it, but also there's lots of people who are probably willing to do it for less. And just seeing those images that Paul had up on the screen, and I know that they're idealised images. We did a similar thing in a local street fair here in Somerset. We had great big, you know, 8-foot panels, plywood panels, which a whole group of people over a 2-week period in the local village hall basically turned up and painted different things on. And we had a before, a small, medium and large, you know, we had a before vision of rural life, you know, there's some bad things and some good things, but it was focused a lot on biodiversity and the current situation and the potential future, which is, you know, truly catastrophic and coming up quite quickly. And we then carried those through the street, those great big things, and now they've been actually fixed permanently onto the side of someone's house next to the car park. So, you know, it's an actual thing that exists there, but the process also was good, and it's only a tiny thing, but I think those, having those visual aids is just really important, because it just saves you millions of words. And also you need, you know, what Julia said, you need it to touch people's hearts somehow, because I genuinely think most people don't change until they feel it.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I saw a program some time ago, and other people who might have seen it will probably remember the information better than I did, but the original New Deal, was it Roosevelt who was behind that? I was surprised at the amount of effort that was put into supporting artists to communicate the message.
Yeah. No, definitely. I think there's something really powerful, and we've seen actually around Lewis and other places now, lots of murals coming up by Extinction Rebellion and other folks. But I think things which depict, you know, what could your town or city look like that are there, that people, you know, walk past all the time, that sort of plant in your imagination the idea of what it could be like.
I guess
cars and more local shops and more green spaces and all those sorts of things. I think that's really, really powerful, as well as perhaps some subvertising and some, you know, defacing of fossil fuel advertising or restrictions on where it can be placed, that type of thing, to sort of put some limits on the negative messaging or the mega messaging that's driving us towards more high consumption of carbon, I think. So, yeah, you wanted to come back on that, or?
Yeah, I suppose the problem is that we can all have our own visions, and for different people it will be different. But the first step is, let's present some alternative visions. The next problem is, even if we have an aspiration, we live in the real world. And until the government get behind it, there's almost no point in just going beyond a wouldn't it be nice stage of thinking. So we really do need to be able to have government and leaders and, you know, figureheads that can really push what it might be, and to to build support for it. But politicians don't do anything unless they've got public support and popular support. So we have to, it's a circle, isn't it? We have to start the popular support bit.
It is, yeah. I think this is hopefully just ways of feeding the imagination about what might be possible and therefore what you might demand of politicians or other.
I can't hear Peter anymore. Has he got a problem with the with his feed, I think?
Yes, I think Peter's frozen momentarily. Oh, I think he's back. Are you back, Peter? You froze for a moment.
Oh, did you not hear what I said? Okay, I can repeat. I was just saying we've only got a couple of minutes left. So it's just a chance for anyone to throw in any other issues or opinions about what they've heard. Hopefully the conversation will carry on. Resources and through the alliance, but if anyone wants to chip in and anybody would like to share at this point, please do so. If not, he's asking, will someone send all these links afterwards? I'm guessing we will. I don't know the mechanics of that. Maybe Sophie can
we can collect all of the links together and put them on the website afterwards. That'll be fine.
We've got everyone's email addresses, right? So we can just collect the links and share them or something like that.
Yeah, we've got everybody's emails from their registrations. Okay. Once we've put all the, you know, the various videos and links up, we can just send the email out to notify everybody.
Okay. So Julia, it looks like you've got your microphone off. Do you want to come in again?
No, just thanks very much. That was really...
Yeah, well, thanks for a fantastic set of contributions and interventions. And it's been fantastic, the amount of resources that are being shared in the group chat box as well. So this is all fantastic. And please, you know, do carry on the conversation with us. And if you have ideas for case studies, people we should be in touch with, events you're organising, you know, do let us know. Let's keep this conversation going. This is really just a starter. And we will also be having other webinars like this on other related themes. So, you know, do look out for those as well. Andrew, did you want to say anything finally?
Or? The only final comment, I suppose, would be that if anybody is listening in and is representative of an organisation who is not already a part of the Alliance and would like to become part of the Alliance, then please do. There's absolutely no cost involved. And the more we can grow the conversation, the more we can have a bigger conversation, the quicker we can disseminate things and the more we can accelerate the process of rapid transition. So, I kind of live and breathe this stuff, and yet I've been sitting here absorbing all kinds of new information and links and examples, which have been incredibly rewarding. So I'm deeply grateful that people have taken part. So I'd say thank you very much, and hand over to you to sign off.
Yeah, well, just again to say thanks very much to Sophie for organising all of this, and Nikki for the comments early on, and to both Pauls, Paul Allen, who wasn't able to share we'll share it by other means. Just some comments about the Leeds experience. I don't think he's on the call anymore, but that was really useful in stimulating conversation. Thank you to all of you for joining us. Please look out for future events and do let us know what you're up to. Take care, everyone. Thanks very much.